and imagine that in 1918, 1917, the British do not take control of Palestine, or agree that Palestine should be a state run by its Arab majority, it's clear there is no Zionism. That's the end of the story, because that Arab majority would simply put an end to this project, which threatens its presence, it threatens it with dispossession. And Arabs come to understand very quickly that, you know, despite the nice talk of coexistence, and Zionist leaders talk a lot about coexistence, we can live together, there's plenty of room in this country for all of us. Inevitably, if you're trying to create a Jewish majority and a Jewish state in what is an overwhelmingly Arab country, this means dispossession. It may mean expulsion, but at a minimum, it means dispossession. It means that the majority will be transformed into minority in its own homeland. And as many Zionist leaders acknowledge privately, if not always publicly, anybody would oppose such a thing, right? Any indigenous population would resist such a thing. And the more far-sighted and hard-headed of the Zionist leaders were already saying very clearly in the 1920s, of course the Arabs will oppose us. And there's no peaceful resolution to this in sight, and the only thing that will decide this is superior force. So ultimately, we have to build up our strength such that we can overcome their resistance and carve out, by force if necessary, a Jewish state in this land, or transform it into a Jewish state, however long that takes and by whatever means prove necessary. Most Zionist leaders were uncomfortable with that formulation, but I think that reflects the logic of the situation very clearly. And this is, I think, very graphically demonstrated in the later 1930s when, in 1936, there was a full-scale Arab revolt against British rule and against the Zionist enterprise, which British rule protected, which went on for 3 years and which was only crushed by the use of massive military force by the British, which in many ways broke the back of the Arab nationalist movement and set the stage for its defeat in 1948. But again, without British protection and support and military might, the growing Jewish community in Palestine, the Zionist project, would likely have gone down the drain. Or come to an end in one form or another. So by the late 1930s, Jews are an increasing proportion of the population, still a minority. They're a minority down to 1948. The Jewish population surges in the 1930s because of what's going on in Europe, essentially. In 1933, the Nazis come to power in Germany and begin stripping German Jews of their citizenship and persecuting them, discriminated against them. There's growing anti-Semitism elsewhere. In Poland, for example, which has a very large Jewish population, the largest Jewish population of anywhere in Europe. And of course, this is also the period of the Depression, when the economic situation is very difficult for everyone. And many Jews would like to emigrate, but they no longer can go to the United States or go to many Western countries. The United States closes its gates to immigration in 1924. There's a wave of nativism, of reaction to immigration, and essentially after legislation in 1924, you have to be from Scandinavia to get into the United States. It's very difficult for anyone else. The U.S. shuts the gates, and so does France and Britain to various extents. Whereas Palestine, at least, is relatively open. So a great many German Jews and Jews from elsewhere come to Palestine because they have no alternative. Even if they're not committed Zionists, this is where they can go to get out of the very difficult situation in their home countries. And so the Jewish population surges, which also sets the stage for the Arab revolt, because suddenly it seems to Arabs that this Zionist idea of a Jewish majority and Jewish state is becoming imaginable for the first time. It's no longer a fantasy, which, you know, maybe will happen in several generations. Jews are now moving on a third of the population, and they're increasingly well-developed. It's increasingly has strong economic foundations. Again, political institutions, military institutions, on and on. So it looks like a state in the making. And this touches off the revolt, the Arab revolt of 1936-39. The revolt is crushed and in many ways ends up strengthening the Jewish community in Palestine because it's forced into self-sufficiency, it's forced to develop its military institutions, it successfully withstands this revolt with British protection, of course, such that by 1939... The Jewish community in Palestine, the Yishuv, led by and part of the Zionist movement, is much, much closer to being able to stand on its own, which is very useful because in 1939, the British government understanding that a new war is looming on the horizon, begins to distance itself from Zionism. It changes policy and basically says, look, we've fulfilled our promises under the Balfour Declaration. We've supported you in creating a national home for the last 20 years. But now, enough is enough. We've done what we said. We need to reconcile Arab opinion, which, of course, is deeply alienated from the British. And the British need the Middle East with the coming war. They need Arab support. They need its oil resources. They need its strategic location. So they back away from Zionism. But by this point, in a way, Zionism has struck down strong enough roots in Palestine so that it can stand on its own, even without the kind of British support it had enjoyed for the previous 20 years. You then have the Second World War, which leads to the extermination of most of the Jews of Europe, which was the mass base which Zionism had always imagined it would eventually bring to Palestine. And Zionism emerged with the argument that there was no future for Jews in Europe, that ultimately they would have to come to the Palestine where they could create a state of their own. And even though only a minority did so, they always imagined that the millions of Jews in Europe would be their future reservoir for the population of the future Jewish state. As the war proceeded, the vast majority of those Jews were murdered. And at the end of the war, Zionism found itself without that mass base, or a small remnant remained. This energized the Zionist movement in a sense. And during the war, for the first time, it began to state very unequivocally that it wanted a Jewish state. It had fudged the language before that, hence the sort of national home. They didn't want to alienate the Arabs or others by talking about a state too explicitly. Now, during the war, they begin calling for a state. And immediately, once the war is over, launch a campaign, a quite successful campaign, to first open up Palestine to Jewish immigration, because the British have imposed restrictions, and then a drive for a Jewish state, which brings them into conflict with the British government. But the Zionist movement, for the first time, has won tremendous international sympathy because of the murder of the Jews of Europe. For the first time, its argument seems much more plausible to a lot of people. Of course, there are other ways of understanding it, but for many people, it seems that supporting the Zionist project of creating a Jewish state in Palestine is reasonable compensation for what the Jews of Europe experienced, the extermination, the suffering, and so forth. And so there's growing sympathy in the United States, especially, which is emerging after 1945, which does emerge in 1945 as the world's superpower, for Zionism, and pressure on the British to open up Palestine to more immigration. And the Zionist movement launches a quite successful diplomatic campaign, lobbying campaign, but also in Palestine, a sort of insurgency to force the British to open up Palestine, to challenge British rule, and sets the stage for Britain being ready to give up its mandate and turning the whole issue over to the United Nations. And the United Nations, after conducting an investigation, comes to the conclusion in the fall of 1947 that Jews, who are now little under one-third of the population, and Arabs, two-thirds plus of the population of Palestine, cannot live together in one state, and that the best solution is to divide Palestine into two states. So this is a tremendous victory for Zionism. Even if many Zionists would have liked all of Palestine or more of it than the one half they were allocated by the United Nations plan, that's still much, much better than nothing, right? Finally, the United Nations seems ready to support the idea of a Jewish state. Needless to say, the Arab majority in Palestine and the Arab national movement and Arabs everywhere reject this. Again, they see this as a gross violation of the Palestinian Arabs' right to self-determination and vow to prevent it. And when the United Nations General Assembly endorses the partition plan, fighting breaks out in Palestine between Arabs and Jews. By this point, the Jewish forces, the Zionist forces, are strong enough to both hold their ground and within a few months defeat the poorly armed, poorly organized, poorly led Palestinian militias and take the offensive. And in May 1948, the Zionist leadership in Palestine proclaims the existence of a Jewish state, which it names Israel. And that's followed immediately by the intervention of military forces from the Arab states to prevent partition, to protect the Palestinians, who are already being displaced, whether because they're fleeing from the fighting or because they're being deliberately expelled by the Jewish and then the Israeli military forces. When the fighting ends, Israel is in control of three-quarters of what was once Palestine. So a lot more, 50% more than the United Nations had allocated originally to the Jewish state. There is no Palestinian Arab state that never emerges for a variety of reasons having to do with the ambitions of the Arab states. And 80% of the Arabs, of the Palestinians who lived in the territory that now becomes Israel, have been dispossessed. The great majority of them either have been expelled by Israeli military forces from their villages, from their towns, from their neighborhoods, or do what civilians do when there's fighting. They fled to get away from the fighting and then found themselves on the wrong side of the border. And Israel made it clear that they could not return and promptly began to demolish their villages, take over their neighborhoods, allocate their fields to neighboring settlements, and so on. And then, so you have the creation of the Palestinian refugee problem through this act of dispossession, which many people have defined as an act of ethnic cleansing, in effect, although that term was not around at the time. So in many senses, this Zionism is, as a movement, a tremendous success. Right? It, from the sort of half-baked idea of these little groups in Eastern Europe, and the notions, the rather grandiose notions of a Viennese journalist in the late 1890s, to actually carving out a state in Palestine and being able to defeat opposition both internally from the Palestinians and externally from the surrounding Arab states, is a tremendous historical achievement for this movement, and help win for solidify the support Zionism had won from many Jews who, until that time, including many American Jews, had been rather ambivalent. Reform Jews in the United States were very anti-Zionist, even later, but ultimately came to terms with it. Many Orthodox Jews who had originally been very anti-Zionist also came to terms with the existence of Israel, even if they didn't see themselves as Zionists. It was a fact. They became part of the new system. So from that point of view, Zionism was a tremendous success. The state which Zionism brought into being, the State of Israel, remains shaped by its origins, in a sense. It remains a Zionist state in some very concrete senses. First and foremost, Israel doesn't define itself as a state of its citizens. Right? The United States is a state of its citizens. If one comes to the United States, or one is born in the United States, and one becomes or is born a citizen, you, at least in principle, have equal rights with every other citizen. We know about racism, we know about the long history of the United States and struggles to actually make that real. But in principle, everybody who's a citizen in the United States has equal rights. And nobody who's not a citizen has special rights. And that's true of liberal democracies generally. That's one of the hallmarks of liberal democracies. Israel doesn't define itself as a state of its citizens. It defines itself as a state of all Jews everywhere. And that's embodied in various laws such that, for example, any Jew from anywhere in the world who wants to come to Israel can become a citizen automatically. Whereas a Palestinian whose ancestors may have lived in this land for many centuries and who happened to be elsewhere in 1947-48 doesn't have those rights and has to apply through naturalization, and Israel has made it pretty clear it's not interested in any more Palestinian citizens. Israel sees itself as a state of all Jews everywhere. It claims to speak for all Jews everywhere, although not all Jews like that idea necessarily. Through that law of return, which grants automatic citizenship, through a whole range of state policies which seek to give Israel's Jewish citizens privileged access to resources, that special position for Jews within Israel is manifested. Something like 18% today of Israel's population, of Israel's citizens, we're talking about within Israel and its 1967 borders, are Palestinians, are Arabs. And they are the descendants of the remnant of the Arab population which remained within Israel's borders after 1948. So they are citizens formally. They can vote in elections. But it's very clear that legally and institutionally, in many ways, they're second-class citizens. Again, they don't have the same automatic right of emigration. The state has systematically, since 1948, pursued policies of, for example, transferring land from Arab ownership or control to Jewish ownership and control, confiscating land from Arab landowners for Jewish settlements within the State of Israel proper, a whole host of means which advantage one segment of the population and disadvantage another segment of the population in a way which would never be seen as acceptable in the United States. Right? If the government of the United States said, you know, only Christian citizens can buy public land, people would think this is a gross violation of equal citizenship and oppose it, right? Yet Israel privileges its Jewish majority in very structural sort of ways. If you look at the allocation of resources, Arab municipalities, Arab towns, Arab communities get far fewer resources for social services, for education, for a whole range of things than do equally sized Jewish towns, settlements, communities. All sorts of social benefits are allocated very disproportionately so that Jews benefit and Arabs do not, or benefit to a much lesser extent. And Israel has also worked very hard through its security apparatus to control its Arab population, to try to depoliticize them, to marginalize them, to make it more difficult for them to demand equal rights, as many have almost since 1948, and certainly more vigorously in recent years as their weight in the population, their level of education, and so on, has risen. So in its symbols, in its language, Israel talks about itself as a Jewish state, and there's no way that that cannot put its non-Jewish citizens in a subordinate position. And those non-Jewish citizens are increasingly resentful of that. And that's entirely separate from what happens in the occupied territories, what happens in the West Bank, Gaza, and so on, which Israel conquers in 1967. This would be an issue, even if that were resolved tomorrow, Israel would still face the issue of its Palestinian minority and the unequal status which that majority is subject to. So in these ways, Zionism still remains relevant, remains intrinsic to Israel's self-definition as a state and to a whole host of institutions, policies, and so on. It's this which sets the stage for debate, which has gone on for quite a few years, about whether Israel can in fact be both Jewish and democratic, whether there's not some contradiction here. If the state defines itself as Jewish, isn't it thereby inevitably subjecting its non-Jewish citizens to a subordinate status? Of course, if it's democratic, then it's not taking Jewishness or lack of Jewishness into consideration as a criterion for resources, for access, for a range of things. And then you have a very different kind of place. And in fact, one of the demands of Israel's Palestinian citizens in recent years has been that Israel should become a state of all its citizens, should become like the United States, where the government does not take religion or race, at least in principle, religion or race or ethnicity into account in terms of citizenship rights. It makes, at least in principle, no difference. We know, of course, historically it's made a lot of difference, and there's been a ongoing struggle to make that happen. But in principle, at least, that's the rule. That's not the case in Israel. The state of Israel classifies its population by nationality into Jews, Arabs, Druze, and so on. And until the last few years, this was stated on everyone's identity card. And it also classifies people by religion, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Druze, etc. Your status, both your national status as defined by Israeli law and policy, and your religious status make an important difference in your access to things, to resources, in ways which would never be tolerated in the United States, which would be seen as fundamentally contradictory to the core principles of a liberal democracy in as practiced in the United States or in Britain or in France or elsewhere. So in that sense, Zionism remains on the agenda, so to speak. It's central to Israel's self-definition. It's important, of course, as well, because after 1967, when Israel conquered the remainder of Mandate Palestine, the West Bank and Gaza, there began a project which has only accelerated over the years for settling these territories, for establishing Jewish settlements, for making them Jewish, in a sense, or many of them, despite the fact that their population remains overwhelmingly Palestinian. And the settlers and those who support them argue that, in a way, this is just the continuation of what Zionism has been doing for the last century. And there's a certain logic to that, which made them very difficult to confront, even by those Israelis who thought the settlement project was a very bad idea, and that Israel should be willing to trade the West Bank and Gaza for peace, make some kind of compromise and divide Palestine with the Palestinians. The settlers and their allies argue that there's a lot of continuity here, that Israel should settle the West Bank as it settled parts of what became Israel in 1948, And, of course, they have a certain biblical history on their side, because the parts of Palestine in which Israel was established in 1948 are not really the parts which were the places where the events of the Bible took place. Right? Those parts of the West Bank, first and foremost. So, especially for religiously inspired nationalist settlers, the West Bank is much more important than Tel Aviv. Right? The events of the Bible took place there. That's where Abraham walked. That's where all these things happened. According to the Bible, at least, reality or mythology, who knows? So there's also a lot of emotional, historical impetus to that. So in that sense, Zionism remains alive, too, because it's used as an argument for the colonization, the Judaification, and that's a term which is used in Hebrew, both for these territories, but also for parts of Israel, of the West Bank. Gaza was always less important. It had no particular historical or emotional resonance, but the West Bank has been the core of this. And those who favor it have a lot of ground to stand on from within the Zionist tradition to argue that these lands should also be colonized, annexed, or at least in their important parts by Israel, that they're part of the land of Israel, all of which should belong or does belong forever to the Jewish people. So in that sense, too, Zionism remains very much on the agenda as a factor, an ideological factor, a cultural factor in Israeli-Jewish society and politics. The question of Zionism is a very fraught one. It's a very sensitive one. I personally don't think it's been helped by the fact that there's a lot of crude Zionist bashing. Right? And Zionism has, in many circles, become synonymous with racism, with apartheid, with a range of things. And of course, one can see the elements of Zionism, you know, not as an abstract ideology, but in practice on the ground in Palestine, which support that. So I think we have to be careful, because for a lot of people... in the United States, at least, for a lot of American Jews, I think identification with Israel is an important part of their Jewish identity. So I think one has to be very careful in dealing with this, because the way to win people over is to give them a better understanding of the situation. And just denouncing Zionism as racism probably isn't going to get you very far, as opposed to trying to find ways to reach people to acquire a better understanding of what concretely goes on the ground, and of how those kinds of things, discriminatory practices within the state of Israel, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, all those things, you know, have links to how Israel defines itself and how it sees itself, and to its origins as a Zionist state, as the product of a Zionist movement, which is comparable with all the differences to other kinds of settler movements which bring people to settle and ultimately to take over from an indigenous population. So that's a very difficult thing. I don't pretend to know exactly how to do this as effectively as one would like. But I think it's also not an impossible task. And I think, in fact, the American Jewish community is much less monolithic, perhaps than it once was, and certainly than its leaders, self-appointed leaders, often like to proclaim it to be. And I think many have been quite distressed by what they see going on. Right? Israel has lately launched a whole new propaganda campaign, because I think they understand that the image of Israel has eroded a great deal, even in the United States, not to speak of Europe, where public opinion, I think, is much more critical, and governments have been much more critical. But even in the United States, and even among Jews, the watching on one's television screen the Israeli assault on Gaza in December 2008, January 2009, was horrifying for a lot of people. And all the rationales that this is necessary for security, and if the Canadians were bombarding Maine, we would do the same thing, and on, don't sit well with a lot of people, and made people think, well, maybe these guys are a little bit out of control, right? Or they're overreacting, or, you know, maybe something different needs to happen here. And that's created some space, and we see this with the emergence of J Street and challenges, a little more space that's emerged within the Jewish community on the surface, and I think greater space beneath the surface, which at least is a hopeful sign. It may not go very far. It's very difficult to predict. But I think there's a possibility of disentangling that emotional identification with Israel with support for Israeli policies, blind support for Israeli policies. And that's, I think, a hopeful thing.
You were just listening to Zachary Lachman, A Brief History of Zionism. This classic from the AR Archives was recorded at NYU in 2010. Zachary Lachman is professor of Middle Eastern Studies and History at New York University. He's a contributing editor to Middle East Report. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Ilan Pape, Michael Parenti, Chris Hedges, Naomi Klein, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Zachary Lachman, A Brief History of Zionism, and for Ilan Pape's book, 10 Myths About Israel, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. PDFs and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Will Singer. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
It's just insane. We have the most insane system of health insurance on the planet. We're the only industrialized country, the only developed country that in which the citizens of the country can go bankrupt or lose their homes or die because they don't have coverage or they get their policies canceled.
That's Wendell Potter, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Wendell Potter on health insurance, an insane system. The murder of UnitedHealthcare CEO on a midtown Manhattan street unleashed, the New York Times reported, a torrent of morbid glee from patients and others who say they have had negative experiences with health insurance companies at some of the hardest times of their lives. Some of the comments were, "Thoughts and deductibles to the family." Another one said, "Unfortunately, my condolences are out of network." The dark commentary highlighted deep anger over the state of health insurance. Millions simply can't afford it and go without. And many who are on some plan have such inadequate coverage and high deductibles that they can't afford to pay for anything. The answer, Ralph Nader says, is single payer. Everybody in, nobody out. That would bring down prices. But the handful of corporations who monopolize the health insurance industry don't want that. Why? That would cut into their profits. So the insanity continues. Our guest today is Wendell Potter. He was a former Cigna public relations executive, and today he's an outspoken critic of the health insurance industry. This classic from the AR archives is even more relevant today than it was when it was originally recorded over a decade ago. Wendell Potter spoke at Powell's Bookstore in Portland, Oregon.
I think I'll begin by just answering a question that I'm often asked when I am speaking to groups, and that is, why did you do what you did? Why don't more people do what you did? And what led you to do what you decided to do? There was no one thing that led me to do this. It was a culmination of a number of things. I had a wonderful career in the health insurance industry. I've actually had two careers. I was a journalist, and I had a very good career as a journalist. I was a reporter initially in Memphis and Nashville, and then finally in Washington, and I covered Congress and the White House and the Supreme Court for a few years. But I decided to go into PR, first in a political campaign. I was a press secretary for a guy who ran for governor of Tennessee. And from there, my PR career just meandered, and it took me from one place to another, and I eventually wound up working for a big for-profit health insurance company, Humana, based in Louisville, Kentucky. At that time, Humana was largely known as a hospital company, and I was hired to help promote and defend and be a spokesperson for the hospitals that the company owned. After doing that for 4 years, I was recruited to Hartford, Connecticut, to support Cigna's healthcare operations. Cigna at that time was a very large multi-line insurance company. It had property and casualty division, a financial services division, a reinsurance division, and I was hired to help raise the awareness of Cigna as a health insurance company. Insurers were beginning to catch on to the fact that a lot of money could be made in health insurance. When I worked at Humana decided to get rid of its hospitals because the executives and shareholders thought that they could make more money if they focused on managed care and health insurance. So they spun the hospitals off to a different company and focused on managed care. And I became the chief spokesperson for Humana and was doing that when I was recruited to Cigna. And Cigna likewise saw that there was a lot of money to be made in health insurance and got rid of its property and casualty division and the other divisions that shareholders felt were not as profitable as health insurance could be. So Aetna did the same thing. Aetna's mix of businesses was very similar to Cigna's during that time, and Aetna did exactly the same thing. It got rid of those other divisions so it could focus on making money on health insurance. When I joined those companies, I thought that managed care was truly a good way to provide finance health care in this country, and I still think that as a concept it's not bad. We have some still very good, I think, solid and reputable players in the managed care space. Some people might disagree, but I think the Kaiser model is one that has worked pretty well for a lot of people, and here in the Pacific Northwest and some other parts of the country, like the northeastern states, where primarily there have been nonprofit organizations that have provided health insurance. What really happened was back about the time that I was working for Humana. Both Humana and Cigna, by the way, are for-profit companies, as you probably know. They're two of seven very large for-profit companies that now dominate the health insurance industry, and I work for two of them. Now, one out of every three Americans is enrolled, if you're insured, in some kind of a benefit plan sponsored by or offered by one of these seven big companies. The for-profit companies began to dominate in the years following the collapse or the failure of the Clinton health care plan. And we saw the conversion of a lot of nonprofit Blue Cross plans to for-profit status. And we saw a consolidation in the industry. And now we have a lot of the Blue Cross plans around the country are owned by this big, gigantic company called WellPoint. So we've seen enormous change in the industry. My point is that initially the concept of managed care was again, something that worked pretty well for a lot of folks. But when these companies saw that they could make a lot of money on managed care, that's when things started getting, our healthcare system took a turn for the significantly for the worse. One of the things that led me to finally decide that I was not in the right business, I was growing increasingly uncomfortable being a spokesman for an industry that was pushing more and more of us into so-called consumer-driven plans. You may have heard the term, but it's a kind of a euphemism for plans that have very high deductibles. And what they are doing is pushing more and more of us into these kinds of plans that require us to pay a lot more money out of our own pockets for care, even if we have insurance. We're paying premiums every month, often as much as we have in the past, but we're getting far less value for it. Often they shrink the benefits or they eliminate benefits, and they make us pay a lot more out of our own pockets. WellPoint has a plan in Maine that is requiring people to pay $30,000 out of their pockets before the insurance will pay a dime. That is the trend, and I was growing increasingly uncomfortable being a spokesman for these kinds of plans. They're extremely profitable for health insurance companies. And that is one reason why these companies have recorded record profits. When I was working for Cigna for 10 years, I handled financial communications. I was the person who explained to reporters who called every time the company announced earnings how the company made its money and whether or not it met Wall Street's expectations. That is the most important thing to these companies, is whether or not you're going to meet Wall Street's expectations for profit. And if you don't, your stock price will go down. And when that happens, if you're an executive, so will your stock options. And you do not want that to happen. So the first priority is always to meet Wall Street's expectations. You're financially invested in this. And the CEOs, for example, at Cigna, the CEO, 90% of his salary is at what they call at risk. And it's determined on whether or not the company performs to Wall Street's satisfaction. And if he doesn't, he doesn't get as much. But if he does, he makes an enormous amount of money, millions and millions of dollars every year. I was worried about these plans, and I did not believe, as I was having to say, that this was the new silver bullet to get more people covered and to provide adequate coverage. What I really was learning was that it is a primary reason why we now have not only 51 million people who are uninsured, we have at least half that many, if not more, 25 million as estimated by the Commonwealth Fund, who are underinsured. They're paying premiums, but they have plans that are so inadequate that if they do get sick, they're going to be on the hook to pay so much out of their own pockets that people are still losing their jobs. You're filing bankruptcy, losing their homes because they simply cannot make the out-of-pocket expenses that's required of them. If you consider that the median household income in this country is still just roughly around $50,000, and the average cost of a family health insurance premium that is purchased through the workplace is about $13,500. If you're having to pay premiums and then a lot of money out of your own pocket, that's not very good value in my book. And but the other thing that I didn't really relish and didn't want to be a part of was helping to defeat healthcare reform. When I worked for Humana and then transitioned to Cigna, it was in 1993, and that was the year that the Clinton health care reform was being debated in Congress. And I played a significant role in helping to defeat that plan. My peers at other companies and I would meet in Washington on a regular basis to develop PR strategies to try to turn people away, to scare people into thinking that this the Clinton plan was a government takeover of the healthcare system, would lead to much higher taxes, would lead to people not having the kind of coverage that they had had in the past and that they valued. So it was a very successful fear-mongering campaign. Fear-mongering is at the core of a lot of these companies' PR strategies. They know that if they can scare people, they can scare them away from reform. And we saw that happening over the past year. And we saw it happening also during the campaigns that led up to the midterm elections. I didn't want to be a part of that again because I knew that we had to do something to try to reform our healthcare system because private insurance companies had not been able to do what they promised to do when the Clinton plan fell. When the Clinton plan fell, the private insurers were saying, give us a chance. Let the free market system help solve the problems in our healthcare system, and we can be there by bringing solutions to the table, to use the term that they've used. Unfortunately, what happened was just the opposite of bringing solutions to the table. It created even more problems. We've seen a steady growth in the number of people who are uninsured and a rapidly growing number of people who are underinsured. And we've seen benefits shrink. And we've seen that they have not been able to control medical inflation. So we've got a problem that is a healthcare system that's even in worse crisis than it was in 1993. But what the health insurance industry had to do was to convince people that the healthcare crisis was not that big of a deal after all, that millions of people still have insurance, they like their insurance, so let's not do anything that might cause people to lose their insurance. And they made people afraid that healthcare reform would result in their possibly losing the insurance that they have and that they value. They were very much involved in the disruption of town hall meetings when Democratic members of Congress were having the town hall meetings all across the country, and you may recall and may have even been to some of the town hall meetings in which people who had been persuaded to be opposed to health care reform came to these meetings to disrupt them, not to listen, not to ask questions, but to disrupt them. And a lot of insurance money, your premium dollars, by the way, have financed a lot of these disruptions. I spoke at one town hall meeting in New Jersey. It was sponsored by Congressman Bill Pascrell in central New Jersey. And he had invited me to speak because it was not too long after I had given my testimony before one of the House panels that he was on. And I was giving a talk sort of like this. I was trying to explain how big insurance companies have been so successful in past years in manipulating public opinion to influence public policy. That's the ultimate objective. It was hard to be heard over the chaos because the Tea Party folks were trying to drown out the speakers, and the folks who were there supporting health care reform were trying to show support for the speakers, so it was just chaos. Afterwards, a woman came up, and I could tell on which side she was on by the sign that she was carrying. It was health care reform, tort reform now, and tort reform is something that the health insurance industry and big business has led us to think is a cure-all for the problems of our healthcare system. It certainly is not. There are some things undoubtedly that probably could be done to improve the tort system and to help improve or address medical malpractice and things of that nature. But it's a diversionary tactic that the insurance industry and others have used to try to get the focus away from some of the real problems in our healthcare system that have been caused by the health insurance industry. But anyway, she was carrying this sign, and I knew that she had been persuaded to think in a certain way. And she said, "No one paid me to be here tonight." And I said, "Ma'am, I know that no one paid you to be here. You didn't get a dime, but a lot of money went into getting you here tonight. And a lot of your premium dollars in this audience and that audience, went into getting those people there to not only make them fearful of health care reform, but to be a part of the anger mongering. It's not just fear mongering, it's anger mongering, to get people so worked up, so angry at members of Congress that they will vote against their own self-interest, as we saw happen during the past midterm election. So I didn't want to be a part of that. I didn't want to be part of yet another effort to defeat reform, and I decided that I was going to leave before I had to be intimately involved in that and playing an active role in defeating reform this time. But this was in 2007. And there were a few things that happened in that particular year that really led me to know that I was not doing the right thing. I was not engaged in right livelihood. I am from East Tennessee, a very rural part of the state, and a very Republican, conservative part of the state, in the very northeastern part of Tennessee. I think every one of my relatives are Republicans, and that's just the way, and they still are. It's one of the most Republican areas in the country. I was back home visiting my folks, and I picked up the local newspaper. This was in June of 2007, July, and I read an article about a healthcare expedition that was being held across the state line. Kingsport, Tennessee, where I grew up, is just right on the border with Virginia. And this expedition was being held in Wise County, Virginia, which is a few miles up the road in the heart of the coal mining area of southwestern Virginia, very remote and quite poor. But it said that people would be driving to this expedition from as far away as Ohio and Georgia and South Carolina. And that's a long drive to get to Wise County, Virginia, a very remote town in the southwestern part of the state. I was curious. I was wondering, why would people do this? And the paper said this was the eighth year it was being done, and that more people showed up every year than the year before. And it was being put on by this organization called Remote Area Medical that started in the 80s. It was started by a guy named Stan Brock. If you ever saw a TV show called Animal Kingdom, I think it was Animal Kingdom. He was one of the actors in that. When he left, he had spent a lot of his time in the Amazon area of South America, and he wanted to do something to help those folks. He became very much aware that people who lived in those remote villages did not have good access to care. So he organized this effort to fly doctors from the U.S. to the Amazon to give people care that they wouldn't have otherwise. And he did the same thing. He would eventually take them to countries in Africa. And he's taken a lot of doctors down to Haiti in recent years. But within a few years after starting this, he realized that the need was just as great, if not greater, in this country as some of the places where he was taking these doctors to the Amazon. So most of the expeditions they do in these days are in the United States, and it's not just in remote areas anymore. One of the biggest is now in Los Angeles. They've been doing it for 2 years. It stretches over 8 days, and thousands of people come to get free care. One of the things I found out when I got there was that most of these folks work. They're not unemployed. They're not shirking their individual responsibility. They would like to have coverage, but for whatever reason, they can't have it. They work for small businesses that don't offer benefits, which is a growing trend in this country. Fewer than half of small businesses now offer health care benefits. A lot of those folks couldn't get insurance at any price because they had pre-existing conditions. In our healthcare system now, the way it's set up, insurance companies will not sell insurance policies to someone who's been sick in the past, and that's been perfectly legal. And I also knew from what I had done at Cigna, the insurance companies will actually dump the sick. They will cancel policies when people get sick. And then that's been perfectly legal as well, too. So a lot of these folks were in, for one reason or another, they did not have coverage. I did find out, though, that of those, there were a lot of people there who did have coverage, but many of them were in these kinds of plans I mentioned earlier, these plans with such high deductibles that they might as well not be covered. They couldn't afford to go to the doctor. And consequently, they stopped going. They're getting sicker. A lot of folks don't pick up their medications that are prescribed for them. More and more don't have dental benefits or vision benefits. One of the greatest needs is in all of these expeditions is for dental care. People just can't afford to go to the dentist. And anyhow, when I borrowed my dad's car and drove up there and I walked through the fairground gates, it was more than I ever imagined. Yes, there were thousands of people who were there. And I found out that many of them had driven the night before and had spent the night in the parking lot of their cars or their pickup trucks, or they camped out. And it was raining. It was summer, but it was a kind of a cold rain that was falling in the mountains there. They had gotten up before dawn and stand in a very long line to get a number to be able to get inside the fairground gates. And once they were inside, they had to stand in long lines once again to get care that was being delivered. I saw when I got there that was being delivered in barns and animal stalls that other volunteers had come just days before to scrub down so that doctors could have somewhat of a sterile place to, if not sterile, at least somewhat clean, to provide the care that these people needed. It wasn't just blood pressure checks, folks. There were doctors there who were removing skin cancers, who were doing colonoscopies, who were mammographies, and you name it. They were doing all kinds of outpatient kinds of treatments, and I could tell that a lot of those folks undoubtedly were people that I could have grown up with in East Tennessee, and undoubtedly there were people from East Tennessee who were there. They could have been people that could have been neighbors of mine, if not relatives. And it was the first time that I had really come face to face with faces of real people who were part of that, what is now 51 million people without insurance. In my job at Cigna, I dealt in numbers, as I mentioned before. I explained how much money the company made and how much in revenues it took in. And I knew, of course, that at that time about 47 million people didn't have insurance. But it was just a number to me. When I got to Wise County, I could no longer just think of it as a number. Those faces haunted me. And I knew that the industry that I worked in was directly responsible in many ways for those people having to stand in long lines and waiting for to be served by doctors who were volunteering their times to provide that care at animal stalls and barns. And I made a commitment to myself that day that I would soon find some other way to make a living. I didn't know what it would be, but I just knew I didn't want to do that very much longer. But it took me some time to process that. 2 weeks later, back at the job in Philadelphia, I had to go to a meeting in Connecticut, and I was going to be flying on the corporate jet, which I did often. And I was flying to Connecticut with the CEO. I'd done this many times. I'd flown not just to Connecticut, but to the West Coast many times and all over the country. And I paid more attention this time than I ever had before. And I noticed that on that short flight, we were served lunch by a flight attendant who was an employee of Cigna, paid, again, by your premium dollars. And we were served lunch on gold-rimmed china. And we were given gold-plated flatware to eat it with. And we were sitting in these luxurious leather chairs. And right all around us was polished mahogany and wood. If you get a chance to fly in a corporate jet, I do it because it's really the way to travel. It makes first class in a commercial flight seem like a cattle car. It was very hard to give that up, and I had taken that for granted that this was my life. This was something that I had earned. I had earned the ability to fly in a corporate jet to meetings. I was I was very well paid. It's hard to walk away from a job like that. But that day, I thought maybe because it had been so recently that I had been to Wise County, I realized that people's premium dollars were helping me to fly that way, and that because of the practices of the insurance industry, those folks in Wise County were having to wait in long lines to get care in animal stalls. It just came together for me at that time that this is what is going on in this country, and that the industry that I worked for was more responsible for the intractable problems in our healthcare system than I think any other part of the healthcare system. It is largely since the industry has become dominated by, these seven large for-profit companies that have as their chief objective, the number one objective, is to meet Wall Street's expectations. And they do these things. They dump the sick just so they can make sure they don't have to pay the claims that might keep them from meeting Wall Street's expectations. There was a congressional hearing And just before I gave my testimony in the Senate for the first time, this House committee was looking into the practice of rescissions, of these companies going back to review a person's application after they've gotten sick. This is a practice in the individual insurance market. Because insurance companies can deny you coverage if you've been sick in the past, a lot of folks lie, or they intentionally leave things out. They can't get insurance otherwise. They know that. I met a guy in San Francisco last year, very wealthy guy. He was an investor. He'd been a serial entrepreneur. He found himself unable to buy insurance at any price because of this. He had been diagnosed with gout at one point in the past, and he had mentioned that on his application, and he could not get insurance for being treated for gout. So his wife, who didn't have to work, had to go back to work for a company that offered benefits so that they would have insurance coverage. It's just insane. We have the most insane system of health insurance on the planet. It became very clear to me that a lot of these practices were causing our problems. The story I was getting at, the point I was making, that this congressional hearing found that just looking at three of the big for-profit companies over 5 years, those three companies alone had rescinded or canceled 20,000 policies of very sick people. That's bad enough, but the reason they did was because they were able to save or avoid paying out more than $300 million in claims. So they look at the big ticket items. They look at the people who are the sickest to cancel their policies. And when that happens, can you imagine being this woman that I was, who was testifying, was notified in the midst of being treated for breast cancer that her company was canceling her insurance. And the reason they gave was that she had been treated for acne in the past, but she had not disclosed that. And they decided that she was not being honest in her application, and they gave them justification to cancel her policy, meaning that she was getting no help to pay her bills for her cancer care. She was all on her own. We're the only industrialized country, the only developed country that in which the citizens of the country can go bankrupt or lose their homes or die because they don't have coverage or they get their policies canceled. It's just, it has been a very common and prevalent practice.
You're listening to Wendell Potter on health insurance, an insane system. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online our website, alternativeradio.org.
I became aware of all of this toward the end of my career as I was going up the corporate ladder and learning more and more about how companies operated and what they did, the links they would go to meet Wall Street's expectations. The reason I did this, going back to what I said earlier, why did I leave? What was it other than these things that happened to me in 2007 and just my growing awareness of what these companies did? And I think it is because of who I, where I came from. I came from that part of the world, and I was a journalist. And I think I came to realize toward the end of my career as a PR guy for the insurance industry that I was doing often the exact opposite of what I was doing as a reporter. And I took my job as a reporter very seriously. I wanted to genuinely tell the truth, to report fact, and to help people understand a situation or something that was happening in ways that would put it in context or perspective. And I tried to keep bias out of my stories because I was an objective reporter. What I realized that I was doing toward the end of my career was the exact opposite of that. I was trying to confuse people or to avoid telling the whole truth by using selective information or disclosing selective information or slicing and dicing data in certain ways to prove a point. And even worse, sometimes intentionally misleading people in some of these fear-mongering campaigns. I became very ashamed of what I was doing. I was not at all proud of what I was doing to earn a living. But the other thing I think that was even more important was because when I saw those folks in Wise County who could have been my neighbors, I remembered my own upbringing, and I can remember my mom in particular saying, "Don't ever forget where you came from." I wrote something about that in the book, and this is the part that I'm going to read. And it's really kind of a tribute to my parents. I was born in Banner Elk, North Carolina on July 16, 1951, not because my parents lived there, but because they didn't have access to affordable quality care in the tiny town where they did live, on the other side of the Blue Ridge Mountains, Mountain City, Tennessee. There was no hospital in Mountain City, or the entire county for that matter. My parents, Blaine and Pearl Potter, were born and raised in Johnson County. Mountain City is the county seat. One of the most beautiful places on earth, in my opinion, but where even today it is hard to make a living. There were only two doctors in all of Johnson County when I was born. My mother didn't want either of them to have anything to do with bringing me into this world. She had heard good things about the hospital in Banner Elk, so that's where Dad drove her, over 30 miles of winding mountainous roads when she went into labor. Affordable quality health care wasn't the only thing my folks didn't have easy access to. Money was another. I've never met a smarter, harder working, and more resourceful man than my dad, but I probably earned more in 1 year at Cigna than he earned in 20, in the 20-some years that he worked in a brutally hot factory before he retired in 1980. Before his factory job, when I was born, he and Mom had a small farm. The main money crop was tobacco, and they ran a little country store called Potter's Grocery on Spear Branch Road outside of Mountain City. Dad built both the store and our first house next door to it with help from a couple of my uncles and cousins. Like most of the houses on Spear Branch Road at the time, ours did not have an indoor bathroom. We would not have one, in fact, until we moved when I was about six to what seemed to me to be a huge city, Kingsport, about 50 miles to the west. For more than a year before we moved to Kingsport, Dad commuted to the Blue Ridge Glass Plant, where a relative had been able to get him a job while my mom stayed back and tended Potter's Grocery. Sometimes Dad was so tired after working a double shift that he would sleep in the back of his 1949 Willys Jeep wagon rather than risk driving exhausted all the way back home to Mountain City. I didn't see a lot of him during that time. And when Potter's Grocery became a money loser, they had to close the store and look for another way to support us. It seems that Mom and Dad had let their out-of-work customers, all of whom were